Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. Something a tiny bit different this week. Our editorial assistant, Matt Beer, reckons that the best race finish ever is the 1997 Portland kart race, where Mark Blundell won by 0.027 seconds in a mixed conditions race that offered pretty much every challenge to a driver that you could possibly offer. So 25 years on, here we are. J.R. Hildebrand's with me, and we've also got the man himself, Mark Blundell. Thanks very much for joining us. I hope you remember 97 fondly.
I do remember 97. Most of it was fondly, but there's a couple of things that still stick in my throat, but there you go.
Before we jump back 25 years ago, just curious to see what you think about the level of competition in IndyCar these days. How much are you following, and what do you think of the current crop?
That's a good question, JR. And actually, I'm suitably impressed, because I think there's a great bunch of guys out there. You've still got the likes of Scotty Dixon doing his magic and, setting the scene to many. But, some great young talent like the Herters and, guys like that coming through. So, listen, I watch IndyCar more than what I watch Formula One. So probably giving you the answer there in where my allegiance lies in watching good motor racing on a Sunday.
You're a man after our own hearts, Mark. I guess we should, just for anyone who's not, well, I guess at this point, you should probably pause the podcast and go back and watch the 97 race, which is available on YouTube to watch all the way through, which JR and I did with great pleasure before speaking to today, Mark. But we should also set the scene just as a bit of context. I guess you came into kart in 96, and I guess towards the end of the season, things really started to come together for you at PacWest there. There was the switch from Goodyear to Firestone tyres, which was really good timing. And then you had the Detroit race, which felt like a bit of a breakthrough for you 2 weeks before Portland, where it was a bit of a gamble at that point to go on a one-stop strategy in car. That wasn't something that was particularly usual at that point, but there was loads of yellows, and you and Mauricio Guzman were running 1-2, but both ran out of fuel late on. I guess that was one of the downsides that you were talking about at the top of the podcast there. I guess that's a big bad memory for you, but let's stick to Portland, because that's the good one. The Firestone wets had improved loads, hadn't they, coming into 97. And I guess by the time we got to Detroit, you had those mixed conditions. Did you feel like a win was possible at that point? You know, a win was on the cards, or was there still a little bit of trepidation there?
No, I think as a team and from my side of things, gelling with the team. I mean, you have to take on board that when I went to IndyCar, I had a very short baptism of fire, because I had a horrendous accident in Rio that kind of gave me a little bit of a wake up call in the dangers of IndyCar racing. And I think, so many guys look at it and sort of frown upon it. But, trust me, as JR will testify, if you haven't done it, then I suggest you be quiet. Because it's pretty tough. Great level of racing, but when you go to the ovals as well, I think everybody should go there with the utmost respect. But fast tracking again, 97 season. I arrived actually with a Mercedes-Benz engine deal, and we couldn't put that deal together until the 97 season. So that's really where everything started to gel. Maurizio and myself, great teammates, pushed each other along, but. Yes, you're right. The Detroit race was one of heartache and agony, but it also gave us a huge boost in understanding that we weren't far away from the win. And Portland, I now and again see it on Twitter, and I see some people like acknowledging that they had a fantastic time watching it. I had a fantastic time driving it, and it's one of those races where many of us who have been race drivers have to make a genuine call on their abilities and in sync with the conditions to say, right, do I want to take the risk? And that's the call that I made, and the risk paid off.
Yeah. What do you remember about the strategy of the race up until that point?
I mean, at this point in time, JR, I mean, strategically, you looked above you and you saw what the weather was, and, you know, you didn't really know what the outcome was going to be. So, you know, several people, as you probably will recall, if you watched the race over, several people made changes on tires. Some of them didn't quite make it at the timing that was going to give them the maximum sort of payback. Some made it very similar to us and actually didn't hang on the black stuff and fell off the road. But I would also say that those conditions as a driver suited me. I've always been competitive in a racing car in, you know, damp, drying conditions. And I honestly take that back to my days as a motocross rider, because I relate to motocross in that, you know, every lap and every corner that you arrived at had changed, and you're always looking for the grip on the circuit. And many a time in those conditions, I would take a very obscure racing line, you know, that harks back to 1984 when I started in Formula 4 1600, and a gentleman called Alan Jenkins, who was a very well-known journalist back in our country, made a comment about it, and I explained to him why, and, you know, he was quite miffed at the fact that I was doing this in a race car. But yeah, 1997 was no different. Portland, those conditions, as you well know, the circuit, and a great circuit, but yeah, right call at the right time for me. And I think that's basically what made the difference. And don't get me wrong, I'm fully understanding that we won the race by a sniff, but it's all about winning, hey? I mean, you know.
You got it done. What, I guess, give us a bit of a time machine back to what it was like to race in those conditions at that time. You said, you know, it's like, look, you look up the sky and see, you know, what's going on. But how much help are you getting from the team and stuff at that point as well? Because we know now, watching IndyCar and even Formula One, how reliant the drivers are on the teams and the strategists and the people watching the weather and all that kind of stuff. You know, how much help did you actually get with those sort of late decision calls that you were making there?
I can tell you, and you can speak to the people back in Packfest who were involved in the team, a couple of things. One, I never really had a spotter, even on the ovals. I mean, very, very limited that we had a spotter giving us information, which sounds kind of crazy, but that's the facts. And actually, you know, car to pit radio back then wasn't the quality that we have today. Pretty much on your shoulders. And, you know, the call of coming in to say, like, I want to take tires was my decision at that point. But yes, they're going to give you some insight and they give you some understanding, but no different to what we would do today. Walk outside, look up in the sky and see that it's got some dark clouds. We didn't have any, you know, Fandango software giving us weather that was a mile out and coming in. It didn't exist. I think, from a perspective of support, massive support back in the pits, but I think most of that was willing me on and you know, willing on that we had the proposition of winning a race. But as we all well know, you know, that proposition actually didn't sort of come to fruition until the very last lap and the last corner. And, you know, and even at that point, I didn't know I'd won the race. I had no knowledge. My first insight into knowing I'd won the race was actually when I got around the corner where JR would relate, where you used to have the big scoreboard, you know, like the pole, and I saw my number sitting at the top. And no one came in the radio to me because they're all too damn excited and they're celebrating.
They were already off celebrating without you.
I want to ask you a quick question just about, so like in this period, we're obviously, you know, my experience in IndyCar has always been, and we see it in Formula One right now with Pirelli on the IndyCar side, it's Firestone. There's just one tire manufacturer. So, you know, everybody's at least on the same, it's sort of a level playing field when you're in these situations, thinking wets, slicks, like, what am I going to do here? 97, Jack mentioned it earlier, like the difference in the Firestone wet from just the previous year was significant, but you've got other guys out there on good years. Like, are you factoring any of that into your kind of like, is that coming into your mind in terms of knowing what other guys are on, kind of measuring slicks versus wets on the guys. I mean, rewatching the race, I'll have to say I was surprised that the cars on wets looked as good as they did on a drying track for as long as they did. Like, I feel like that's not something that we get out of an IndyCar wet tire these days. So just walk us through, or walk us through for the sake of the listeners, of kind of what that thought process was like, and what being a part of that development process with the tires was like over the couple of years that you were there.
I mean, you're right. The Firestone took a huge leap in its advancement with the rain tire. You know, Goodyear, I think, was pretty much the staple diet for anybody if you wanted a wet tire that was workable. In terms of me factoring in the differential between the competitors on Goodyear and Firestone, I'll be honest, no, it didn't factor in. The factoring from my side was, that's the level of grip that's achievable out in the circuit at the moment. That's what I'm confident of handling. I know what I think I can do with a car with a set of wets on, and I know what I think I can do with a set of cold slicks. You know, and I'm going to take the risk, because I know if I get on the slicks and I get them up to temp, then I'm going to make some fast progress. And I felt comfortable and confident to do that. So that's really the only thing that factors in my mind. And, you know, you'll be aware, back in those days, I mean, it's always horrendous to talk about back in those days, but, you know, we were 900 horsepower, no traction control, no power steering. You know, it was a bit of a brute of a car. I mean, incredible fun to drive, but they were a handful. And, you know, the slightest little twitch, and you got the thing swelled up on the turbo, and it would lose you in a heartbeat. So, yeah, there was lots of exciting times. Lots of people were off in the boonies, and lots of them managed to sort of do something a little bit special on the day. But I'm going to sort of put my neck on the line and say, you know, I think we had a great package and we had a great combination on the day that paid off just at the right moment. And if it maybe was a lap later, maybe it would have gone a different way. Maybe Raul would have had the win. But in saying that, you know, I had to marginalize my exit off the corner as it was, because Gilles was doing a great job of being defensive, as you would. And to this day, I still know that it's sort of like grinds on him that he lifted his arm in celebration, only to find out that he was second and not the winner. But yeah, it's those days come and go. But you know, that's a race day that everyone would like to have the name against for a sort of performance like that. But it's extra special to a driver, and again, you'll relate, JR, that you know what you do in the car, and you know how difficult it is. And when you pull it together and it comes off, then you know they sit there in your top little five in your little sweet spot. So that'll be the children's story, you know, the grandkids' story that I tell them. You know, if we still got YouTube, then I don't know.
I was going to ask you about you mentioned sort of being backed up into Raul at the end there as well, and obviously Gilles was doing a good job of kind of moving you around the track with the way he was defending, and I guess it'd be, you know, it's kind of cool to get into your, you know, your mindset behind the visor to kind of hear what you were thinking. I guess, did you feel, you know, I don't want to say desperate, because I don't think, you know, it didn't look like you were driving like you were desperate at any point there, but you knew Raul was coming and you knew that the time was running out towards the end of the race there. What was the level of desperation to try and get that move done? Or did you know that it was going to be at the last corner on the last lap?
No, I mean, I didn't know. As you are in those conditions, there are always opportune moments. And you'll see that I'm moving around the circuit a lot, trying to see where the weaknesses were, the driver in front of me. I think Christian gave me a little run for my money on a couple of occasions, Fittipaldi out there. And like I say, it's, and probably what you related to earlier, JR, is like, you know, you'll see the guys searching for the water on the circuit to keep those tires cooler. And you probably see a lot more of that back in those days than what you do in today's world. But, you know, I was comfortable and confident, and I knew that I had one opportune moment on the last corner of the last lap to outdrag him. You know, and we managed to do it. We didn't have DRS back in those days, didn't have any of those sort of fandangled developments, but it was all about timing. And as I say, that timing, maybe if the straight would have been 100 meters longer before the checkered flag, maybe the outcome would have been different. But, you know, who cares? Because I took the win, so I'm in the history book. So that's that.
I was going to say, it all looks all well and good when you see it on the stat sheet. I want to actually just dig back in. So it's funny that you mentioned motocross as sort of a something that you related to here. And I bring that up because I had a conversation years ago with Mario, and he was talking about how, you know, back when he was racing, when he was at Lotus and F1, that I'm trying to think of who the he was over there with the world champ, the Kenny Roberts, was racing, you know, Grand Prix bikes at the same time, which were, you know, at a time when those things were just absolute monsters, and that the two of them had this chat about how all the Europeans thought that they'd be lousy when the weather got bad, but both of them had dirt racing backgrounds, right? So Kenny had raced flat track for years, you know, Nicky Hayden, kind of the more modern example of coming from that type of background and being good in those types of conditions on a bike. Mario had raced dirt, you know, for his entire upbringing. And so they actually looked at that in a pavement situation as being a huge advantage. So I want to hear a little bit more about how you related to being on two wheels on the dirt and how that kind of factored into your kind of mindset, your feel for the car. And I thought that was super interesting to hear you say.
So I think there's two aspects to it. And I don't know whether you've sort of looked over the years, but there's actually been several bike guys that have transferred into a car and they've been pretty successful.
Yeah,
you know, Jeff Ward comes to mind in the US.
Yeah,
even
absolutely.
I think Jeff maybe was actually Scottish, but I think he's been in the US for a long, long time. But
we consider him an American.
Yeah. Or I'm trying to think of the other Eddie. Now it will come to me. Anyway, he was, you know, MotoGP rider and went and did IndyCar. There's been a lot of guys who have done the transition.
Eddie Lawson.
There you go. Eddie Lawson, well done. So I think there's two things there. I think one of the biggest things for me, and you'll relate to this, is, and people like overlook it or don't kind of mention it, I think it's balance. It sounds stupid that you're strapped into a racing car, but like your feel for in a balance, you know, it sounds stupid, I know, but it's actually a relative. Put yourself in your road car, you know, put your seat right up to the steering wheel. I'm not recommending this by any means, but put your seat right up to the steering wheel and, like, you know, drive like this. And all of a sudden your balance, your inner body, outer body experience completely changes because your comfort and your confidence goes. You can't read the machinery.
Yeah.
And I think that's a relative thing for drivers that they probably don't give credit to, but bike riders will. And also for me, motocross taught me exactly what I said earlier. You come into a corner, and just because the racing line is, you know, A to B to C exit, doesn't mean to say in those conditions it's the fastest line. Because if I see a high spot and the high spot is a little bit drained of water, I know full well that I can reach it, brake on a sixpence, turn it, and accelerate off. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that I always used to look for. And you'd quite often, again, JR, you relate, you'll see a lot of guys sticking to the racing line, whether it's wet or dry. Not always the optimum line, you know, and maybe we've given some secrets away. So if you want to send us $9.95 and I'll send you a postal address, then please send in your money. Anyway.
Yeah, I think I'm totally with you on that. I think it's really cool to hear and, you know, to hear about sort of the adaptability and the, you know, there's some creativity that starts to creep in there, you know, that we talk about that a lot, you know, just the kind of being in that state of flow when you're in the car, but some of it also, you know, you lean on your past experiences and some of the little things that inform the way you think about that. So that's really cool to hear. I guess jumping back to the race itself, where does that race stack up for you? It was your first kart win. You went on to win two more in this season. Was that sort of a breakthrough? Is this still the one that you look back at, you know, most fondly?
I think it's a great race to look back at because it was so special in the way that we achieved the win. And I know what the effort was that went in behind the wheel in those conditions. So you always relate to that. For me, actually, that year was fantastic because we won on a street course, a road course, and an oval. So I kind of like the fact that we sort of achieved all the disciplines and had some success. But, you know, yeah, the first one's always going to be special. It was our team owner, Bruce McCaw's backyard, because he came from Seattle. So, you know, it was quite nice to have sort of like a home race for him and a home victory. And for the team, I think for PacWest Racing, everyone had seen the sort of 96 season and the emergence of the team start to get stronger. And then when we had that sort of that lift, the whole thing took on another sort of level. And I think, you know, everybody lifted their game, Maurizio included. I think everyone sort of, you know, really got, and we got some real momentum. So, you know, I'm fond of those memories. I'm fond of the time of racing in America, and I'm fond of IndyCar full stop. And I'm a big fan as of today still.
So I'm going to jump ahead to Fontana. Just talk to us about running on, you know, 2 mile oval back then. I mean, I've raced in Fontana in the modern era, but it was a whole different animal back then.
I hope you had a spotter there, Mark.
No.
That's incredible.
Isn't that crazy? Like, that's just completely nuts to me that you guys, I mean, I knew that, but it's still just wild to think that in those days going, you know, 250 down the straights or whatever, like, spotter. It was definitely a whole different ball of wax.
So I think from my side, I know Big Mo did the outstanding lap that he did. I think from my side, I think it was 253 miles an hour and 227 in the corner. That was our ultimate lap on my side of the garage. Okay. I mean, listen, you know yourself, driving an oval is a pretty hair-raising experience at the best of times. But for me, it's one of those experiences that it's either a white-knuckle ride, and, you know, any time in your racing career, it's one of those times when it's not going right, you just want to pack the suitcase and leave the pit lane and go home because it's scary. Or everything is in tune, and it's some of the best motor racing you will ever do in your career. Because when you could go side by side, two other guys, and if you were able to literally put your arm out and touch their shoulder because you're running that close, that's something that is exhilarating and thrilling. And, you know, to do that over a 500-mile duration is something quite special to get to the end of it. That race was, again, a racing driver's commitment and decision-making process taken in a very short space of time, because I finished that race with blisters on my right rear tire that, you know, like the size of a cup, you know, in no ways really would you have actually continued other than knowing that you had a handful of laps left and it was a do or die moment. You either went for it and you run the risk of the tire letting go and not finishing the race, or you go for it and say, you know what, I'm running the pace. I think we're going to have a chance of winning. And I know to this day, probably, that Jimmy sits there, Jimmy Vassar, and is a little bit miffed and a bit frustrated, but hey, that's racing. And I will take the victory in the 500 mile race. Cause for me, you know, that was a highlight of my motor racing career, to actually win a 500 mile oval. JR, you know what they're like, the tough cookies to break, but if you can put your name on the trophy, then fantastic. We'll take it. My biggest regret is the year after they had $1 million prize money.
So it's bad timing. No, that's very cool.
Yeah, Mark, you've gone on to, you know, achieve so much more since your kart career, with your, obviously everyone will know your commentary career, and now you've got the successful management company as well, MB Partners. Obviously, I guess sort of living your motorsport career through some of the people you work with now, some of the younger guys that you work with to a certain extent. But just give us an idea of this period. You know, we've talked about, I think indirectly, we've talked about lots of different elements that make up how good this era was, whether it was the competition, the level of drivers in the championship at the time, the different engine manufacturers, different tire manufacturers, you know, the tracks that we had back then, some fantastic tracks that aren't around now. And then, yeah, we've talked about the fact that teams could move up and down and move around so much more freely back then than maybe they do now. Just give us an idea of where you kind of place this period in motorsport history. It's got to be up there with, you know, one of the best sort of 5 or 6 year periods at least. And maybe people will look at it a little bit differently in terms of the years, but that period was strong.
I honestly think it was a great time in, you know, you're right, it was kart championship auto racing teams, because of course at this stage we had to break away with the RRL. Fundamentally, my biggest regret in my career is that I never got to race at the Indianapolis 500. So when I went across the pond, in my contract was Indy 500, and then I signed it, and then not too long after that we had to split, and our team decided to go to kart. So I never got to go to Indy, which was always a frustration because I had, I think, out of 6 500 races, I think I had 5 top 6 finishes, 1 win and a second. So I always set the car up for 500 miles rather than setting out for an ultimate lap. But in terms of general sort of feeling of, yeah, that as an era, I think it was a great time. I really do. We had some fantastic drivers. We had some great teams, some beautiful circuits, as you say, and some close motor racing. And for me, you know, again, JR will relate. It's all about that gladiatorial stuff. It's about being toe-to-toe with somebody and, you know, putting yourself against them and coming out the other end and going like, yeah, I set the guy up. I achieved the pass. And I've gone on to take a successful result from it. And, you know, great teamwork. And don't get me wrong, they were brilliant cars to race. 900 horsepower. I mean, who wouldn't want 900 horsepower under the right foot?
JR would like that a lot, I think.
Yeah, I'm not gonna even comment because it's making me jealous.
Mark, thanks so much for coming on to give us a snapshot into this race, and I definitely recommend going back on YouTube and watching that and some of Mark's other brilliant performances in his career as well, whether that be in IndyCar or outside. I always remember, I don't know if this is going to offend you, Mark, I really hope it doesn't, but when I think of you, I always think of the helmet and the Pat West livery and your helmet. I guess you just don't tend to get the connection of a helmet design and a livery as much as we used to back then. And
as long as you're not relating that to the movie Driven.
No, absolutely not.
Because for me, it's probably the worst. It's probably the worst motor racing movie in the world. But anyway,
that's something we can all agree on.
Yeah, it wasn't me in the helmet. It was Jimmy Blythe. So let's go there for Jimmy.
Brilliant. Thanks again for spending some time with us, Mark Blundell, on the Race IndyCar podcast. Thanks very much.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, that was Mark Blundell. If you've not already, definitely go back and just watch that 1997 Portland race, mainly because my boss, Matt Beer, is demanding that everyone does. He'll be very upset if people haven't gone back and watched it. JL, what did you think of Mark?
Has he memorized how many views it has so he can...
I don't know if he's memorized how many views it has.
Exactly how many people we get to go watch it again. That's going to be how we're measured this week.
Yeah, like his level of knowledge about that race is quite outstanding, and it even goes... You know, we can even get into the context of, like, we were talking with Mark about the tires, the development of the wet tires, and that the Firestones were about 5 seconds off at Detroit the year before. So they went to a load of tracks and just flooded the tracks to test, which is just, you know, some Bernie Eccleston type stuff, isn't it? You just wouldn't get that now for sure, because the insurance wouldn't allow it. But just some details like that, just. They're the kind of things that really make this time, you know, so, so special. But yeah, that was good, wasn't it, JR? It's nice to get, you know, Mark doesn't mince his words. He's very honest, and everything just sort of, you know, comes out as is. And it's, you always get the feeling that you sat right there with him in the car and that you're kind of looking out the visor with him.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, you know, rewatching that era from kart, you know, it's interesting. We talk a lot these days, whether it's, you know, out in the open or kind of behind the scenes, just about the vehicle formula, basically, right? Like what's the combination of, you know, regardless of exactly how you achieve it, what's the combination of power, torque, mechanical grip of the car, aero grip, drag, you know, all of this stuff. And it's interesting that, you know, in this day and age, the technology exists, you know, you see it across motorsport to kind of like hit the lap time that we're currently running in any variety of ways, you know, whereas back then just everything wasn't quite as refined. And so, I mean, it is kind of wild looking back at the event. Like the lap time that they ran back then is basically the same that we're running right now. So, you know, the cars ultimately haven't really gotten any faster in like 20 years, which is, I can say, having spent my entire IndyCar career in that window, it's a little bit, there's a part of it that makes me sad, but that just seeing the way that the cars achieved the lap time and seeing the onboards and seeing how analog the experience was for one, and IndyCar is still very analog compared to F1 and anything else. But, you know, having to take your hand off the steering wheel, like, you know, just little things like that, that they suck you into the driver's experience so much more, because it just looks like chaos, you know, like these guys out there on, you know, even the wets in like drying conditions, you know, clearly just because they're not getting the traction, like because the car, the rear tire is just not hooking up. It's like, you think about the stiffness of the throttle springs must have been pretty heavy, because they're not at any point getting a full throttle for like the entire, until they get back to the front straightaway, you know. They're just having to really work the car, and it was interesting listening to Mark talk about just kind of that sensation of balance behind the wheel and how important that is, particularly in those kinds of situations, you know, where it's just, the car is kind of squirming around. It's not doing anything perfectly. You almost have to imagine yourself like removing yourself a little bit from the seat to just kind of have a bit of spatial awareness for like, what's going on here? How do I just roll the most speed through these corners and make this happen when you've got an overwhelming amount of power sitting right behind you, and those turbocharged, you know, 2.65 liter engines at the time that lasted, you know, through the end of Champ Car, basically. So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we talk a lot, and Mark was obviously careful not to do too much of, you know, a back in the day segment, but it is, you know, when you talk to guys about driving in that period. You know, I remember I've spoken with Dario about this, who was in that race, I think his rookie year, I think, in 97.
Yeah.
That, you know, he was just like, it was just different, you know, like you'd show up after being out of the car for like a month, maybe, like not even that long in the off season. And he made a funny comment once that, you know, there were times that you'd like ask for a diff change after the first run, just to give yourself like an hour to get your shit together before you had to get back in the car. And so it's cool to see that. And it's, you know, it really is an important era of IndyCar racing or of, you know, open wheel racing in the US for lots of reasons. You know, but cool to see it. And obviously, you know, these guys that were a part of it look back on it, you know, with fond memories. So definitely cool to hear from Mark's perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, you know, Dario, with Hogan was in there, and, you know, cause we were talking about the level of competition and stuff and the people around there. And obviously you had Herta with Ray Hall as well. And, you know, just a really good group of mix of teams and drivers, and even a little bit like now, I guess, where some of those teams like Ray Hall and Hogan maybe wouldn't be there every race, but they'd be, you know, there or thereabouts in a few of them, and would make things interesting. So yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed that segment. And to be honest, if this podcast was just about 1997 and 1998, I would be okay with that, to be honest. But we digress, because we need to get into some current IndyCar. I'll run through a couple of things that I wanted to mention, JR, and then I'll grab you for what you're looking at from Portland. I think the very interesting thing is that this is basically now a Penske and Ganassi title fight, with a couple of outsiders in the mix, but not really in the mix, I think, at this point. I think we're fair to say that it's a Penske Ganassi fight to the finish now. I think the interesting thing is that they've both kind of reversed what they did last year. So Ganassi have tested at Laguna and Penske have tested at Portland. So both, I guess it's the exact reverse of what they did last year. So it'll be interesting to see if that impacts things in any way, shape or form. I know Joseph Newgarden and Will Power are both really keen to test at Portland to try and find something there. And I know Ganassi weren't particularly happy with how they were as a team at Laguna last year, even though the results weren't too bad. So that's a really interesting element and something to consider when you're watching the results this weekend and looking at how things stack up is to note that they've obviously tested at those venues. So even if Penske maybe have a little bit of an edge at Portland, that doesn't mean you can rule Ganassi out of having the similar edge at Laguna, I guess. So that'll be really interesting to watch. And we should just cover off a couple of indiscretions, I guess. We had Romain Grosjean crash at Portland, not big ones. Marcus Ericsson had a little incident at Laguna as well. But apart from that, I think it was all pretty straightforward and everyone's kind of head down for this kind of weird like week and a half break we've had now between Gateway and then just two rapid fire races to finish the season. What are you going to be looking out for? And is there anything you've kind of got your eye on looking at this weekend at the moment?
Well, I guess I think that, you know, this year in particular, it has seemed like the teams that have gone testing at these places or, you know, certainly the contenders, when they've gone testing, they've made real gains, which is, you just don't always see quite as direct a correlation between those things. Sometimes you see teams go test and they're still looking for it, you know, when they show up. So I'm expecting, you know, and it's worth remembering that while Penske last year at Portland didn't look great ultimately in qualifying, that they were really fast throughout practice. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a head scratcher last year, trying to figure out like, why do these guys not end up? And same thing, frankly, at Laguna for those guys that, you know, throughout after the testing that they did at Laguna last year and then showing up to the race through practice, they looked good and then just didn't find it in qualifying kind of when it counted. So, you know, I'm expecting for them to have kind of reconciled that at Portland in particular, because they've gone testing. We know that Ganassi was really strong there last year, just throughout, you know, they stuck a couple of cars right up at the front qualifying, and then, you know, Pillow and Scott both went to the end on kind of a weird alt strategy when they got put to the back, and it basically just ended up not impacting their chances that dramatically, because it put them at a bit of a strategic advantage having pitted from the back early in the race and being able to go longer on fuel through the duration of it. But honestly, at this point, I'm looking forward to having the two strongest teams that have the contenders all being good at both of these places, you know, despite the fact that there are definitely other drivers that'll end up in the mix. You'll have, I think, Colton, Rossi. These are places that both of those guys have been really strong at. Grosjean is a bit of a dark horse at both of these tracks. Just, you know, he's been kind of hit or miss this year, but can certainly operate at a high level at both these places. Malukas was fast in the test at Laguna, I guess, was where they tested. Interestingly, Scott Dixon was not particularly competitive in the overall sheet at the end of the day at Laguna, but you got to figure that they'll kind of take the learnings from that. Pillow was 2/10 up on everybody else over the course of the weekend or over the course of the test. So you got to figure that they'll be able to kind of rectify, you know, they'll be able to find the pace that Pillow had. So I guess that's all just to say the Aero McLaren cars, there's plenty of guys who can find themselves up front, but I think that we'll end up, I'm expecting to end up with the championship battle coming down to the wire, with there being a win on offer and it coming down to not just who finishes ahead of who else, but maybe it being down to like somebody needing to win the last race to be able to cement their championship standing. So, you know, again, another just great example of IndyCar producing this type of year-end championship battle year after year without any kind of, you know, gimmicks across the course of the season outside of, you know, as we talk about double points at Indy or whatever. But you know, it's even without that having played out, we'd still be in this spot basically here at this point in the year. So it's going to be a great couple of races to watch at historic venues. I mean, these are both places that were on the schedule in 97, right? So they've been difference makers for a long time.
I heard you mention double points there. You just have to, you're like poking me to make me dance, aren't you? It's like, dance for me, Benyon, dance for me. Tell me more about these double points at the 500. I'm not going there, JR. We're not doing it again. We're not doing it ever. No, we will do it again because I'll get annoyed about it at some point. But I'm in a good mood at the moment, so we're not going to fall into that trap. I do think it's important to mention you talked about the strategy last year, and if anyone's watching Portland for the first time this year, you didn't catch last year's race, and it's worth at least grabbing the bite-sized 15-minute highlights on YouTube. If not, grab the full highlights, or if you are able to watch it back in full, then do that, because it's such an interesting race. And obviously, I had that early, it wasn't really a shunt, but it was just everyone going off like Skittles at turn one, which seems to happen at Portland every single year on at least one restart. And you had those guys all drop as far back as 16th, and then Alex came from 16th to win the race. And it was all strategy, in the sense that he was able to come back from 16th. But the Ganassi cars, as you mentioned, did have the pace to also kind of match that and make that work. So that was a really interesting race. And it shows that if you're watching this race for the first time, if someone goes off at the first corner, don't rule them out, because they might win the race. You never know what's going to happen at Portland. It's a really interesting race. It's always tactically very entertaining. So that's definitely one to pick up. Before then, we'll be back to talk about what's happened at Portland and fire up Laguna Seca for a championship finale preview. So make sure you hit us up with that. Before then, we'll have plenty of content on the-race.com. You can also email us on the podcast, podcasts@the-race.com. If you've got any questions for me or JR, or you've got anything that you want the podcast to cover, whether that's special guests or topics that you like. If you like this kind of more retro themed episode that we've gone for this week, Mark's going to hate me saying the word retro, isn't he, in relation to him? I'm not trying to make Mark feel old, but that is more of a retro vibe than we usually go for. Let's put it that way, JR, so that it's not offensive. But like I said earlier, JR and I would quite happily do 97 as every episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. So we definitely don't have a problem with it. So yeah, drop us an email, let us know. You can also, if you've got questions, you can send us a voice note and we can pop that into the podcast, so you can, virtually join JR and I on an episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. We'd be happy to have you. So that's all for this week's episode, and we'll catch you after Portland.
The Athletic.